like singing. Everybody can do enough to satisfy themselves, though it may not impress the neighbors as being very much. That is the way it is with me. But whether I know anything unusual, I couldn't say. Don't look for me to call a string of names and point out chapter and verse. Ladies do not kiss and tell any more than gentlemen do. I have read many books where the heroine was in love for a long time without knowing it. I have talked with people and they have told me the same thing. So maybe that is the way it ought to be. That is not the way it is with me at all. I have been out of love with people for a long time, perhaps without finding it out. But when I fall in, I can feel the bump. That is a fact, and I would not try to fool you. Love may be a sleepy, creeping thing with some others, but it is a mighty wakening thing with me. I feel the jar, and I know it from my head on down. Though I started falling in love before I was 7 years old, I never had a fellow until I was nearly grown. I was such a poor picker. I would have had better luck if I had stuck to boys around my own age, but that wouldn't do me. I wanted somebody with long pants on, and they acted as if they didn't know I was even born. The heartless wretches would walk right past my gate with grown women and pay me no attention at all, other than to say hello or something like that. Then I would have to look around for another future husband, only to have the same thing happen all over again. Of course, in high school, I received mushy notes and wrote them. A day or two, a week or month at most, would see the end of the affair. Gone without a trace. I was in my freshman year in college when I first got excited, really. He could stomp a piano out of this world, sing a fair baritone, and dance beautifully. He noticed me, too, and I was carried away. For the first time since my mother's death, there was someone who felt really close and warm to me. This affair went on all through my college life, with the exception of two fallings out. We got married immediately after I finished my work at Barnard College, which should have been the happiest day of my life. St. Augustine, Florida, is a beautiful setting for such a thing. But it was not my happiest day. I was assailed by doubts. For the first time since I met him, I asked myself if I really were in love, or if this had been a habit. I had an uncomfortable feeling of unreality. The day and the occasion did not underscore any features of nature nor circumstance, and I wondered why. Who had canceled the well-advertised tour of the moon? Somebody had turned a hose on the sun. What I had taken for eternity turned out to be a moment walking in its sleep. After our last falling out, he asked me please to forgive him, and I said that I did. But now, had I really? A wind full of memories blew out of the past and brought a chilling fog. This was not the expected bright dawn. Rather, some vagrant ray had played a trick on the night. I could not bring myself to tell him my thoughts. I just couldn't, no matter how hard I tried. But there they were, crowding me from pillar to post. Back in New York, I met Mrs. Mason, and she offered me the chance to return to my research work, and I accepted it. It seemed a way out without saying anything very much. Let nature take its course. I did not tell him about the arrangement. Rather, I urged him to return to Chicago to continue his medical work. Then I stretched my shivering insides out and went back to work. I have seen him only once since then. He is married again, and I hope that he is happy. Having made such a mess, I did not rush at any serious affair right away. I set to work and really worked in earnest. Work was to be all of me, so I said. 3 years went by. I had finished that phase of research and was considering writing my first book when I met the man who was really to lay me by the heels. I met PMP. He was tall, dark brown, magnificently built with a beautifully modeled back head. His profile was strong and good. The nose and lip were especially good front and side, but his looks only drew my eyes in the beginning. I did not fall in love with him just for that. He had a fine mind, and that intrigued me. When a man keeps beating me to the draw mentally, he begins to get glamorous. I did not just fall in love, I made a parachute jump. No matter which way I probed him, I found something more to admire. We fitted each other like a glove. His intellect got me first, for I am the kind of woman that likes to move on mentally from point to point, and I like for my man to be there way ahead of me. Then if he is strong and honest, it goes on from there. Good looks are not essential, just extra added attraction. He had all of those things and more. It seems to me that God must have put in extra time making him up. He stood on his own feet so firmly that he reared back. To illustrate the point, I got into trouble with him for trying to loan him a quarter. It came about this way. I lived in the Graham Court at 116th Street and 7th Avenue. He lived down in 64th Street, Columbus Hill. He came to call one night, and everything went off sweetly until he got ready to leave. At the door, he told me to let him go because he was going to walk home. He had spent the only nickel he had that night to come to see me. That upset me, and I ran to get a quarter to loan him until his payday. What did I do that for? He flew hot. In fact, he was the hottest man in the five boroughs. Why did I insult him like that? The responsibility was all his. He had known that he did not have his return fare when he left home, but he had wanted to come, and so he had come. Let him take the consequences for his own acts. What kind of a coward did I take him for? How could he deserve my respect if he behaved like a cream puff? He was a man. No woman on earth could either lend him nor give him a cent. If a man could not do for a woman, what good was he on earth? His great desire was to do for me. Please, let him be a man. For a minute I was hurt, and then I saw his point. He had done a beautiful thing, and I was killing it off in my blindness. If it pleased him to walk all of that distance for my sake, it pleased him as evidence of his devotion. Then, too, he wanted to do all the doing and keep me on the receiving end. He soared in my respect from that moment on, nor did he ever change. He meant to be the head, so help him over the fence. That very manliness, sweet as it was, made us both suffer. My career balked the completeness of his ideal. I really wanted to conform, but it was impossible. To me, there was no conflict. My work was one thing, and he was all of the rest. But I could not make him see that. Nothing must be in my life but himself. But I am ahead of my story. I was interested in him for nearly 2 years before he knew it. A great deal happened between the time we met and the time we had any serious talk. As I said, I loved, but I did not say so, because nobody asked me. I made up my mind to keep my feelings to myself since they did not seem to matter to anyone else but me. I went south, did some more concert work, and wrote Jonas Gordvine and Mules and Men, then came back to New York. He began to make shy overtures to me. I pretended not to notice for a while so that I could be sure and not be hurt. Then he gave me the extreme pleasure of telling me right out loud about it. It seems that he had been in love with me just as long as I had been with him, but he was afraid that I didn't mean him any good, as the saying goes. He had been trying to make me tell him something. He began by complimenting me on my clothes. Then one night when we had attended the Alpha Phi Alpha fraternity dance, yes, he is an alpha man, he told me that the white dress I was wearing was beautiful, but I did not have on an evening wrap rich enough to suit him. He had in mind just the kind he wanted to see me in. And when he made the kind of money he expected to, the first thing he meant to do was buy me a gorgeous evening wrap and everything to go with it. He wanted his wife to look swell. He looked at me from under his eyelashes to see how I was taking it. I smiled, and so he went on.
You know, Zora, you've got a real man on your hands. You've got somebody to do for you. I'm tired of seeing you work so hard. I wouldn't want my wife to do anything but look after me. Be home, looking like Skookums when I got there.
He always said I reminded him of the Indian on the Skookum apples. So I knew he meant me to understand that he wanted to be coming home to me. And with those words, he endowed me with Radio City, the General Motors Corporation, the United States, Europe, Asia, and some outlying continents. I had everything. So actively began the real love affair of my life. He was then a graduate of City College and was working for his master's degree at Columbia. He had no money. He was born of West Indian parents in the Columbus Hill district of New York City and had nothing to offer but what it takes, a bright soul, a fine mind in a fine body, and courage. He is so modest that I do not think that he yet knows his assets. That was to make trouble for us later on. It was a curious situation. He was so extraordinary that I lived in terrible fear lest women camp on his doorstep in droves and take him away from me. I found out later on that he could not believe that I wanted just him. So there began an agonizing tug of war. Looking at a very serious photograph of me that Carl Van Vechten had made, he told me one night, in a voice full of feeling, that that was the way he wanted me to look all the time, unless I was with him. I almost laughed out loud. That was just the way I felt. I hated to think of him smiling unless he was smiling at me. His grins were too precious to be wasted on ordinary mortals, especially women. If he could only have realized what a lot he had to offer, he need not have suffered so much through doubting that he could hold me. I was hog-tied and branded, but he didn't realize it. He could make me fetch and carry, but he wouldn't believe it. So when I had to meet people on business or went to literary parties and things like that, it would drive him into a sulk, and then he would make me unhappy. I, too, failed to see how deeply he felt. I would interpret his moods as indifference and die and die and die. He begged me to give up my career, marry him, and live outside of New York City. I really wanted to do anything he wanted me to do, but that one thing I could not do. It was not just my contract with my publishers. It was that I had things clawing inside of me that must be said. I could not see that my work should make any difference in marriage. He was all and everything else to me but that. One did not conflict with the other in my mind, but it was different with him. He felt that he did not matter to me enough. He was the master kind. All or nothing for him. The terrible thing was that we could neither leave each other alone nor compromise. Let me seem too cordial with any male and something was going to happen. Just let him smile too broad at any woman, and no sooner did we get inside my door than the war was on. One night, I didn't decide this. Something primitive inside me tore past the barriers, and before I realized it, I had slapped his face. That was a mistake. He was still smoldering from an incident a week old. A fella had met us on 7th Avenue and kissed me on my cheek. Just one of those casual things, but it had burned up PMP, so I had unknowingly given him an opening he had been praying for. He paid me off then and there with interest. No broken bones, you understand, and no black eyes. I realized afterwards that my hot head could tell me to beat him, but it would cost me something. I would have to bring Head to get Head. I couldn't get his and leave mine locked up in the dresser drawer. Then I knew I was too deeply in love to be my old self. For always a blow to my body had infuriated me beyond measure. Even with my parents, that was true. But somehow, I didn't hate him at all. We sat down on the floor, and each one of us tried to take all the blame. He went out and bought some pie, and I made a pot of hot chocolate, and we were more affectionate than ever. The next day he made me a bookcase that I needed, and you couldn't get a pin between us. But fate was watching us and laughing. About a month later, when he was with me, the telephone rang. Would I please come down to an apartment in the 50s and meet an out-of-town celebrity? He was in town for only 2 days, and he wanted to meet me before he left. When I turned from the phone, PMP was changed. He begged me not to go. I reminded him that I had promised and begged him to come along. He refused and walked out. I went, but I was most unhappy. This sort of thing kept up time after time. He would not be reconciled to the thing. We were alternately the happiest people in the world and the most miserable. I suddenly decided to go away to see if I could live without him. I did not even tell him that I was going, but I wired him from some town in Virginia. Miss Barnacle of New York University asked me to join her and Alan Lomax on a short bit of research. I was to select the area and contact the subjects. Alan Lomax was joining us with a recording machine. So because I was delirious with joy and pain, I suddenly decided to leave New York and see if I could come to some decision. I knew no more at the end than I did when I went south. 6 weeks later, I was back in New York and just as much his slave as ever. Really, I never had occasion to doubt his sincerity, but I used to drag my heart over hot coals by supposing. I did not know that I could suffer so. Then all of my careless words came to haunt me. For theatrical effect, I had uttered sacred words and oaths to others before him. How I hated myself for the sacrilege now. It would have seemed so wonderful never to have uttered them before. But no matter how soaked we were in ecstasy, the telephone or the doorbell would ring, and there would be my career again. A charge had been laid upon me, and I must follow the call. He said once with pathos in his voice that at times he could not feel my presence. My real self had escaped him. I could tell from both his face and his voice that it hurt him terribly. It hurt me just as much to see him hurt. He really had nothing to worry about, but I could not make him see it. So there we were, caught in a fiendish trap. We could not leave each other alone, and we could not shield each other from hurt. Our bitterest enemies could not have contrived more exquisite torture for us. Another phase troubled me. As soon as he took his second degree, he was in line for bigger and better jobs. I began to feel that our love was slowing down his efforts. He had brains and character. He ought to go a long way. I grew terribly afraid that later on he would feel that I had thwarted him in a way and come to resent me. That was a scorching thought. Even if I married him, what about 5 years from now, the way we were going? In the midst of this, I received my Guggenheim Fellowship. This was my chance to release him and fight myself free from my obsession. He would get over me in a few months and go on to be a very big man. So I sailed off to Jamaica. But I freely admit that everywhere I set my feet down, there were tracks of blood. Blood from the very middle of my heart. I did not write because if I had written and he answered my letter, everything would have broken down. So I pitched in to work hard on my research to smother my feelings. But the thing would not down. The plot was far from the circumstances, but I tried to embalm all the tenderness of my passion for him. In their eyes were watching God. When I returned to America after nearly 2 years in the Caribbean, I found that he had left his telephone number with my publishers. For some time I did not use it. Not because I did not want to, but because the moment when I should hear his voice, something would be in wait for me. It might be warm and eager. It might be cool and impersonal, just with overtones from the grave of things. So I went south and stayed several months before I ventured to use it. Even when I returned to New York, it took me nearly 2 months to get up my courage. When I did make the call, I cursed myself for the delay. Here was the shy, warm man I had left. Then we met and talked. We both were stunned by the revelation that all along we had both thought and acted desperately in exile, and all to no purpose. We were still in the toils, and after all my agony, I found out that he was a sucker for me, and he found out that I was in his bag. And I had a triumph that only a woman could understand. He had not turned into a tramp in my absence, but neither had he flamed like a newborn star in his profession. He confessed that he needed my aggravating presence to push him. He had settled down to a plodding desk job and reconciled himself. He had let his waistline go a bit, and that bespoke his inside feeling. That made me happy no end. No woman wants a man all finished and perfect. You have to have something to work on and prod. That waistline went down in a jiffy, and he began to discuss work plans with enthusiasm. He could see something ahead of him besides time. I was happy. If he had been crippled in both legs, it would have suited me even better. What will be the end? That is not for me to know. Life poses questions, and that two-headed spirit that rules the beginning and end of things, called death, has all the answers. And even if I did know all, I am supposed to have some private business to myself. What I do know, I have no intention of putting but so much in the public ears. Perhaps the oath of Hercules shall always defeat me in love. Once when I was small and first coming upon the story of the choice of Hercules, I was so impressed that I swore an oath to leave all pleasure and take the hard road of labor. Perhaps God heard me and wrote down my words in his book. I have thought so at times. Be that as it may, I have the satisfaction of knowing that I have loved and been loved by the perfect man. If I never hear of love again, I have known the real thing. So much for what I know about the major courses in love. However, there are some minor courses which I have not grasped so well and would be thankful for some coaching and advice. First is the number of men who pant in my ear on short acquaintance. You passionate thing, I can see you are just burning up. Most men would be disappointing to you. It takes a man like me for you. Ah, I know that you will just wreck me. Your eyes and your lips tell me a lot. You are a walking furnace. This amazes me sometimes. Often when this is whispered gustily into my ear, I am feeling no more amorous than a charter member of the Union League Club. I may be thinking of turnip greens with dumplings or more royalty checks. And here is a man who visualizes me on a divan, sending the world up in smoke. It has happened so often that I have come to expect it. There must be something about me that looks sort of couchy. Maybe it is a birthmark. My mother could have been frightened by a bed. There is nothing to be done about it, I suppose, but I must say about these mirages that seem to rise around me that the timing is way off on occasion. Number two is, a man may lose interest in me and go where his fancy leads him, and we can still meet as friends. But if I get tired and let on about it, he is certain to become an enemy of mine. That forces me to lie like the cross ties from New York to Key West. I have learned to frame it so that I can claim to be deserted and devastated by him. Then he goes off with a sort of twilight tenderness for me, wondering what it is that he's got that brings so many women down. I do not even have to show real tears. All I need to do is show my stricken face and dash away from him to hide my supposed heartbreak and renunciation. He understands that I am fleeing before his allure so that I can be firm in my resolution to save the pieces. He knew all along that he was a hard man to resist, so he visualized my dampened pillow. It is a good thing that some of them have sent roses as a poultice and stayed away. Otherwise, they might have found the poor, heartbroken wreck of a thing all dressed to kill and gone out for a high-heel time with the new interest, who has the new interesting things to say and do. Now, how to break off without acting deceitful and still keep a friend? Number 3 is kin to number 2 in a way. Under the spell of moonlight, music, flowers, or the cut and smell of good tweeds, I sometimes feel the divine urge for an hour, a day, or maybe a week. Then it is gone, and my interest returns to cornpone and mustard greens, or rubbing a paragraph with a soft cloth. Then my ex-sharer of a mood calls up in a fevered voice and reminds me of every silly thing I said and eggs me on to say them all over again. It is the third presentation of turkey hash after Christmas. It is asking me to be a seven-sided liar, accuses me of being faithless and inconsistent if I don't. There is no inconsistency there. I was sincere for the moment in which I said the things. It is strictly a matter of time. It was true for the moment, but the next day or the next week is not that flakes. Like snowflakes, they get that same look from being so plentiful and falling so close together. But examine them closely and see the multiple differences between them. Each moment has its own task and capacity and doesn't melt down like snow and form again. It keeps its character forever. So the great difficulty lies in trying to transpose last night's moment to a day which has no knowledge of it. That look, that tender touch, was issued by the mint of the richest of all kingdoms. That same expression of today is utter counterfeit, or at best, the wildest of inflation. What could be more zestless than passing out canceled checks? It is wrong to be called faithless under circumstances like that. What to do? I have a strong suspicion, but I can't be sure, that much that passes for constant love is a golded-up moment walking in its sleep. Some people know that it is the walk of the dead, but in desperation and desolation, they have staked everything on life after death and the resurrection, so they haunt the graveyard. They build an altar on the tomb and wait there like faithful Mary for the stone to roll away. So the moment has authority over all of their lives. They pray constantly for the miracle of the moment to burst its bonds and spread out over time. But pay no attention to what I say about love, for as I said before, it may not mean a thing. It is my own bathtub singing. Just because my mouth opens up like a prayer book, it does not just have to flap like a Bible. And then again, anybody whose mouth is cut crossways is given to lying, unconsciously as well as knowingly. So pay my few scattering remarks no mind as to love in general. I only know my part. Anyway, it seems to be the unknown country from which no traveler ever returns. What seems to be a returning pilgrim is another person born in the strange country with the same-looking ears and hands. He is a stranger to the person who fared forth, and a stranger to family and old friends. He is clothed in mystery henceforth and forever, so perhaps nobody knows or can tell any more than I. Maybe the old Negro folk rhyme tells all there is to know. Love is a funny thing. Love is a blossom. If you want your finger bit, poke it at a possum. Chapter 15. Religion. You wouldn't think that a person who was born with God in the house would ever have any questions to ask on the subject. But as early as I can remember, I was questing and seeking. It was not that I did not hear. I tumbled right into the Missionary Baptist Church when I was born. I saw the preachers and the pulpits, the people and the pews. Both at home and from the pulpit, I heard my father, known to thousands as Reverend Janot, an abbreviation for John, explain all about God's habits, his heaven, his ways and means. Everything was known and settled. From the pews, I heard a ready acceptance of all that Papa said. Feet beneath the pews beat out a rhythm as he pictured the scenery of heaven. Heads nodded with conviction in time to Papa's words. Tense snatches of tune broke out, and some shouted until they fell into a trance at the recognition of what they heard from the pulpit. Come love feast, some of the congregation told of getting close enough to peep into God's sitting room windows. Some went further. They had been inside the place and looked all around. They spoke of sights and scenes around God's throne. That should have been enough for me, but somehow it left a lack in my mind. They should have looked and acted differently from other people after experiences like that. But these people looked and acted like everybody else, or so it seemed to me. They plowed, chopped wood, went possum hunting, washed clothes, raked up backyards, and cooked collard greens like anybody else. No more ornaments and nothing. It mystified me. There were so many things they neglected to look after while they were right there in the presence of all power. I made up my mind to do better than that if ever I made the trip. I wanted to know, for instance, why didn't God make grown babies instead of those little measly things that messed up ditties and cried all the time? What was the sense in making babies with no teeth? He knew that they had to have teeth, didn't he? So why not give babies their teeth in the beginning, instead of hiding the toothless things in hollow stumps and logs for grannies and doctors to find and give to people? He could see all the trouble people had with babies rubbing their gums and putting wood lice around their necks to get them to cut teeth. Why did God hate for children to play on Sundays? If Christ, God's son, hated to die, and God hated for him to die, and have everybody grieving it over ever since, why did he have to do it? Why did people die anyway? It was explained to me that Christ died to save the world from sin, and then, too, so that folks did not have to die anymore. That was a simple, clear-cut explanation. But then I heard my father and other preachers accusing people of sin. They went so far as to say that people were so prone to sin that they sinned with every breath they drew. You couldn't even breathe without sinning. How could that happen if we had already been saved from it? So far as the dying part was concerned, I saw enough funerals to know that somebody was dying. It seemed to me that somebody had been fooled, and I so stated to my father and two of his colleagues. When they got through with me, I knew better than to say that out loud again, but their shocked and angry tirades did nothing for my bewilderment. My head was full of misty fumes of doubt. Neither could I understand the passionate declarations of love for a being that nobody could see. Your family, your puppy, and the new bull calf, yes, but a spirit away off who found fault with everybody all the time, that was more than I could fathom. When I was asked if I loved God, I always said yes, because I knew that that was the thing I was supposed to say. It was a guilty secret with me for a long time. I did not dare ask even my chums if they meant it when they said they loved God with all their souls and minds and hearts and would be glad to die if he wanted them to. Maybe they had found out how to do it. And I was afraid of what they might say if they found out I hadn't. Maybe they wouldn't even play with me anymore. As I grew, the questions went to sleep in me. I just said the words, made the motions, and went on. My father being a preacher and my mother superintendent of the Sunday school, I naturally was always having to do with religious ceremonies. I even enjoyed participation at times. I was moved, not by the spirit, but by action, more or less dramatic. I liked revival meetings particularly. During these meetings, the preacher let himself go. God was called by all of his praise-giving names. The scenery of heaven was described in detail. Hallelujah Avenue and Amen Street were paved with gold so fine that you couldn't drop a pea on them but what they rang like chimes. Hallelujah Avenue ran north and south across heaven and was tuned to sound alto and bass. Amen Street ran east and west and was tuned to treble and tenor. These streets crossed each other right in front of the throne and made harmony all the time. Yes, and right there on that corner was where all the loved ones who had gone on before would be waiting for those left behind. Oh, yes, they were all there in their white robes, with the glittering crowns on their heads, golden girdles clasped about their waists, and shoes of jeweled gold on their feet, singing the hallelujah song and waiting. And as they walked up and down the golden streets, their shoes would sing, "Soul me, soul do," at every step. Hell was described in dramatic fury. Flames of fire leaped up 1,000 miles from the furnaces of hell and raised blisters on a sinning man's back before he hardly got started downward. Hellhounds pursued their ever-dying souls. Everybody under the sound of the preacher's voice was warned, while yet they were on pleading terms with mercy to take steps to be sure that they would not be a brand in that eternal burning. Sinners lined the mourner's bench from the opening night of the revival. Before the week was over, several or all of them would be under conviction. People, solemn of face, crept off to the woods to praying ground, to seek religion. Every church member worked on them hard, and there was great clamor and rejoicing when any of them come through religion. The pressure on the unconverted was stepped up by music and high drama. For instance, I have seen my father stop preaching suddenly and walk down to the front edge of the pulpit and breathe into a whispered song. One of his most effective ones was, "Run, run, run to the city of refuge, children. Run, oh run, or else you'll be consumed." The congregation, working like a Greek chorus behind him, would take up the song and the mood and hold it over for a while, even after he had gone back into the sermon at high altitude. "Are you ready? Ha! For that great day! Ha! When the moon shall drape her face in mourning! Ha! And the sun drip down in blood! Ha! When the stars, ha! Shall burst forth from their diamond sockets! Ha! And the mountains shall skip like lambs! Ha! Havoc will be there, my friends! Ha! With her jaws wide open! Ha! And the sinner man, ha! He will run to the rocks! Ha! And cry, oh rocks! Ha! Hide me! Ha! Hide me from the face of an angry God! Ha! Hide me! Oh! But the rocks shall cry, ha! Get away, sinner man, get away! Ha!" Tense harmonic chant seeps over the audience. "You run to the rocks!" Chorus, "You can't hide." Soloist, "Oh, you run to the rocks." Chorus, "Can't hide." Soloist, "Oh, run to the mountain. You can't hide." All, "Can't hide, sinner. You can't hide." Rocks cry, "I'm burning too. Ha! In the eternal burning. Ha! Sinner man. Ha! Where will you stand? Ha! In that great getting up morning. Ha!" The congregation would be right in there at the right moment, bearing Papa up and heightening the effect of the fearsome picture 100-fold. The more susceptible would be swept away on the tide and come through, shouting, and the most reluctant would begin to waver. Seldom would there be anybody left at the mourner's bench when the revival meeting was over. I have seen my father bring through as many as 75 in 1 2-week period of revival. Then a day would be set to begin the induction into the regular congregation. The first thing was to hear their testimony or Christian experience, and thus the congregation could judge whether they had really got religion or whether they were faking and needed to be sent back to lick the calf over again. It was exciting to hear them tell their visions. This was known as admitting people to the church on Christian experience. This was an exciting time. These visions are traditional. I knew them by heart, as did the rest of the congregation, but still it was exciting to see how the converts would handle them. Some of them made up new details. Some of them would forget a part and improvise clumsily or fill up the gap with shouting. The audience knew, but everybody acted as if every word of it was new. First, they told of suddenly becoming conscious that they had to die. They became conscious of their sins. They were godly sorry, but somehow they could not believe. They started to pray. They prayed and they prayed to have their sins forgiven and their souls converted. While they laid under conviction, the hellhounds pursued them as they ran for salvation. They hung over hell by one strand of hair. Outside of the meeting, any of the listeners would have laughed at the idea of anybody with hair as close to their heads as 99 is to 100 hanging over hell or anywhere else by a strand of that hair. But it was part of the vision, and the congregation shuddered and groaned at the picture in a fervent manner. The vision must go on. While the seeker hung there, flames of fire leaped up and all but destroyed their ever-dying souls. But they called on the name of Jesus, and immediately that dilemma was over. They then found themselves walking over hell on a foot log so narrow that they had to put one foot right in front of the other while the howling hellhounds pursued them relentlessly. Lord, they saw no way of rescue, but they looked on the other side and saw a little white man, and he called to them to come there. So they called the name of Jesus, and suddenly they were on the other side. He poured the oil of salvation into their souls, and hallelujah, they never expect to turn back. But still they wouldn't believe. So they asked God if he had saved their souls to give them a sign. If their sins were forgiven and their souls set free, please move that big star in the west over to the east. The star moved over. But still they wouldn't believe. If they were really saved, please move that big oak tree across the road. The tree skipped across the road and kept on growing just like it had always been there. Still, they didn't believe. So they asked God for one more sign. Would he please make the sun shout so they could be sure? At that, God got mad and said he had shown them all the signs he intended to. If they still didn't believe, he would send their bodies to the grave, where the worm never dies, and their souls to hell, where the fire is never quenched. So then they cried out, "I believe! I believe!" Then the dungeon shook and their chains fell off. Glory, I know I got religion. I know I've been converted and my soul set free. I never will forget that day when the morning star burst in my soul. I never expect to turn back. The converts shouted, ecstatic cries, snatches of chants, old converts shouting in frenzy with the new. When the tumult finally died down, the pastor asks if the candidate is acceptable, and there is unanimous consent. He or she is given the right hand of fellowship, and the next candidate takes the floor, and so on, to the end. I know now that I liked that part because it was high drama. I liked the baptisms in the lake, too, and the funerals for the same reason. But of the inner thing, I was right where I was when I first began to seek answers. Away from the church after the emotional fire had died down, there were little jokes about some of the testimony. For instance, a deacon said in my hearing, "Sister Sini ought to know better than to be worrying God about moving the sun for her. She asked him to move the tree to convince her, and he done it. Then she took and asked him to move a star for her, and he done it. But when she kept on worrying him about moving the sun, he took and told her, says, 'I don't mind moving that tree for you, and I don't mind moving a star just to pacify your mind, because I got plenty of them.
I ain't got but one son, Sini, and I ain't gonna be shoving it around to please you and nobody else. I'd like mighty much for you to believe, but if you can't believe without me moving my son for you, you can just go right on to hell. The thing slept on in me until my college years, without any real decision. I made the necessary motions and forgot to think. But when I studied both history and philosophy, the struggle began again. When I studied the history of the great religions of the world, I saw that even in his religion, man carried himself along. His worship of strength was there. God was made to look that way, too. We see the Emperor Constantine as pagan, as he could lay in his hide, having his famous vision of the cross with the injunction, "In hoc signo vinces," and arising next day not only to win a great battle, but to start out on his missionary journey with his sword. He could not sing like Peter, and he could not preach like Paul. He probably did not even have a good straining voice like my father to win converts and influence people. But he had his good points, one of them being a sword and a seasoned army. And the way he brought sinners to repentance was nothing short of miraculous. Whole tribes and nations fell under conviction just as soon as they heard he was on the way. They did not wait for any stars to move, nor trees to jump the road. By the time he crossed the border, they knew they had been converted. Their testimony was in on Christian experience, and they were all ready for the right hand of fellowship and baptism. It seems that Reverend Brother Emperor Constantine carried the gospel up and down Europe with his revival meetings to such an extent that Christianity really took on. In Rome, where Christians had been looked upon as rather indifferent lion bait at best, and as keepers of virgins in their homes for no real good to the virgins among other things at their worst, Christianity mounted, where before emperors could scarcely find enough of them to keep the spectacles going. Now they were everywhere, in places high and low. The arrow had left the bow. Christianity was on its way to world power that would last. That was only the beginning. Military power was to be called in time and time again to carry forward the gospel of peace. There is not apt to be any difference of opinion between you and a dead man. It was obvious that two men, both outsiders, had given my religion its chances of success. First, the Apostle Paul, who had been Saul, the erudite Pharisee, had arisen with a vision when he fell off of his horse on the way to Damascus. He not only formulated the religion, but exerted his brilliant mind to carry it to the most civilized nations of his time. Then Constantine took up with force where Paul left off with persuasion. I saw the same thing with different details happen in all the other great religions, and seeing these things, I went to thinking and questing again. I have achieved a certain peace within myself, but perhaps the seeking after the inner heart of truth will never cease in me. All sorts of interesting speculations arise. Will military might determine the dominant religion of tomorrow? Who knows? Maybe Franklin Delano Roosevelt will fall on his head tomorrow and arise with a vision of Father Divine in the sky and the motto, "Peace. It's wonderful," glowing like a rainbow above it. Maybe our president would not even have to fall off of a horse or a battleship, as the case might be. If Father Divine should come to control 30 million votes, the president could just skip the fall, that is, off of the horse. Then we might hear the former Franklin D. Roosevelt addressed as sincere determination. Eleanor would be divine eternal commutation. Celestial bountiful tribulations would be Sister Frances Perkins. Harry Hopkins, angelic saintly shadow. His vocal honor, LaGuardia, would be known as always sounding trumpet, and on his evident good works in his nursery, Harold Ickes would be bound to win the title of fruitful love abounding. Things getting into a fix like that, sincere determination,
being Archangel in the first degree, could have the honor of handing Father Divine his first bite at every meal. Celestial B. Tribulations would be in the kitchen dividing the opinion of the cooks. Eleanor Divine Commutation would be a tidings angel spreading the new gospel far and wide. The Senate chamber would be something to see. All of the seats in the center taken out and a long table loaded down with baked hams, turkeys, cakes, and pies, all ready for the legislative session to begin. With Father Divine at the head and Sincere Determination at the foot, slicing ham and turkey for the saints, there might not be much peace, but the laws would be truly wonderful. The saints would not overeat either, what with being forced to raise their hands and cry, "Peace!" every time Father Divine spoke, and "It's truly wonderful!" every time Sincere Determination uttered a sound. Their eating would be negligible. It would be a most holy conclave around that table. Sincere Determination would naturally be Senate President, seated under a huge picture of Father Divine. There would be no more disturbing debates and wrangling. The Lord would pass the law to Sincere Determination, and he would pass it on to the Senate. The Senate would pass their plates for more ham and salad. Father Divine would confine himself to pontifical audiences and meditation. He might even get himself a shoe embroidered with a quarter two of jewels for the dowagers of Park Avenue, Beacon Street, and Sutton Place to have the extreme pleasure of kissing. His foot would be in it, of course. He wouldn't belittle a lady by sending out a cold shoe for impressively devout lady angels to kiss like that. Naturally, Sincere Determination would be able to read the divine mind and then pass on which ones rated crowns of empire and which didn't. It would be the privilege of our angelic admirals and generals, puissant defenders of the faith, to demote all infidels and correct all typographical errors, emperor to impotent, and vice versa. According as a man worships, so is he, as the saying goes. Naturally, there would be no more private money. Father would hold it all for everybody. No more just homes, every house, a heaven, peace. Our holy fighting men would have high-arching wings that covered up their mouths but left their ears wide open, a splendid type of fighting saints. Don't think this impossible because of certain natural difficulties. Father Divine's looks need not be any drawback, nor a stumbling stone to our religious faith. Just let him collect enough votes, and he will be a sure enough pretty man in this world. Men with no more personal looks than he have founded all of our great religions. After all, the cradle of a creed is no Hollywood casting office. So, having looked at the subject from many sides, studied beliefs by word of mouth and then as they fit into great rigid forms, I find I know a great deal about form, but little or nothing about the mysteries I sought as a child. As the ancient tent maker said, I have come out of the same door wherein I went. But certain things have seemed to me to be true as I heard the tongues of those who had speech and listened at the lips of books. It seems to me to be true that heavens are placed in the sky because it is unreachable. The unreachable, and therefore the unknowable, always seem divine, hence religion. People need religion because the great masses fear life and its consequences. Its responsibilities weigh heavy. Feeling a weakness in the face of great forces, men seek an alliance with omnipotence to bolster up their feeling of weakness, even though the omnipotence they rely upon is a creature of their own minds. It gives them a feeling of security. Strong, self-determining men are notorious for their lack of reverence. Constantine, having converted millions to Christianity by the sword, himself refused the consolation of Christ until his last hour. Some say not even then. As for me, I do not pretend to read God's mind. If he has a plan of the universe worked out to the smallest detail, it would be folly for me to presume to get down on my knees and attempt to revise it. That, to me, seems the highest form of sacrilege. So I do not pray. I accept the means at my disposal for working out my destiny. It seems to me that I have been given a mind and willpower for that very purpose. I do not expect God to single me out and grant me advantages over my fellow men. Prayer is for those who need it. Prayer seems to me a cry of weakness and an attempt to avoid, by trickery, the rules of the game as laid down. I do not choose to admit weakness. I accept the challenge of responsibility. Life as it is does not frighten me, since I have made my peace with the universe as I find it, and bow to its laws. The ever-sleepless sea in its bed crying out, "How long?" to time. Million-formed and never-motionless flame, the contemplation of these two aspects alone affords me sufficient food for 10 spans of my expected lifetime. It seems to me that organized creeds are collections of words around a wish. I feel no need for such. However, I would not, by word or deed, attempt to deprive another of the consolation it affords. It is simply not for me. Somebody else may have my rapturous glance at the archangels. The springing of the yellow line of morning out of the misty deep of dawn is glory enough for me. I know that nothing is destructible. Things merely change forms. When the consciousness we know as life ceases, I know that I shall still be part and parcel of the world. I was a part before the sun rolled into shape and burst forth in the glory of change. I was when the earth was hurled out from its fiery rim. I shall return with the earth to Father Son and still exist in substance when the sun has lost its fire and disintegrated in infinity to perhaps become a part of the whirling rubble in space. Why fear? The stuff of my being is matter, ever-changing, ever-moving, but never lost. So what need of denominations and creeds to deny myself the comfort of all my fellow men? The wide belt of the universe has no need for finger rings. I am one with the infinite and need no other assurance. Chapter 16. Looking Things Over. Well, that is the way things stand up to now. I can look back and see sharp shadows, highlights, and smudgy in-betweens. I have been in sorrow's kitchen and licked out all the pots. Then I have stood on the peaky mountain, rapping in rainbows, with a harp and a sword in my hands. What I had to swallow in the kitchen has not made me less glad to have lived, nor made me want to low-rate the human race, nor any whole sections of it. I take no refuge from myself in bitterness. To me, bitterness is the underarm odor of wishful weakness. It is the graceless acknowledgement of defeat. I have no urge to make any concessions like that to the world as yet. I might be like that someday, but I doubt it. I am in the struggle with the sword in my hands, and I don't intend to run until you run me. So why give off the smell of something dead under the house while I am still in there tussling with my sword in my hand? If tough breaks have not soured me, neither have my glory moments caused me to build any altars to myself where I can burn incense before God's best job of work. My sense of humor will always stand in the way of my seeing myself, my family, my race, or my nation as the whole intent of the universe. When I see what we really are like, I know that God is too great an artist for we folks on my side of the creek to be all of his best works. Some of his finest touches are among us, without doubt, But some more of his masterpieces are among those folks who live over the creek. I see, too, that while we all talk about justice more than any other quality on earth, there is no such thing as justice in the absolute in the world. We are too human to conceive of it. We all want the breaks, and what seems just to us is something that favors our wishes.